You're now listening to the Diversity Roundtable. I'm Pamela Xaba, entrepreneur, inclusion enthusiast, and the founder of Nonkosi Creatives with over two decades as a corporate HR professional. My goal is to give you insights into conversations with entrepreneurs and corporate professionals who have insightful stories of triumph and leadership. I uncover my personal journey from cultivating diversity and promoting inclusive communities. We'll also find out why building a prosperous society is vital for leadership roles. Subscribe and get ready to rise, lead, and help define the spirit of South African excellence.
Hey everyone, Marlene here, Franklin Covey, South Africa. We develop exceptional leaders at every level. We build personal and interpersonal skills. We create high trust cultures and we provide powerful execution frameworks. So come learn why other Fortune 500 companies vote us, Franklin Covey, the most trusted leadership company in the world.
Good day. Thank you for coming in. Thank you for tuning in. This is episode 13 for the Diversity Roundtable. I am your host, Pamela Xaba. I am so excited. It's amazing how time flies. We are in May already. It's also my birthday month. The 2nd of May was my birthday. So I'm really, really excited and I feel very blessed to have one of the most amazing females in our country today. You will hear from her as she talks about her story, her life experiences, and her organization that she started in May 2015. But before I introduce her, you know, we're still so also very excited from my previous episode where we had Jabu Zwane, Michael from the US, and his team, Alethea and Brett, where they were sharing some of the most valuable lessons on DEI work on a global context. You know, we are so blessed to have them in our network. So coming back to why are we here today on episode 13, we've got the wonderful, the beautiful Busisiwe Hlatshwayo, the founder of an organization that supports and advocates for women. Not only just women, you know, her organization is called Black Women in the Workplace. It's quite a loaded name for an organization. So that's what actually piqued our curiosity as the Diversity Roundtable to say, let us invite Busi. It's amazing what social media does. Look, I'd never met this woman, this remarkable human being called Busisiwe Hlatshwayo. I've just met her on social media, one of the platforms, following her, looking for diversity experts in our country, and I came across an organization called Black Women in the Workplace, and I thought, sure, what is this about? What is she talking about? What are some of her life experiences? What inspired her to start this organization? So before I steal her thunder and trip over myself, let me welcome Busisiwe, our wonderful, our beautiful, and amazing human being, Busisiwe Hlatshwayo. Over to you, Busi.
Thank you so much, Pam. Happy birthday.
Thank you.
It's a whole bad month if you are.
Yes. No, thank you so much. Thank you for allowing us to talk to you and actually for dedicating your time and your space. We are invading your space, but the things that you talk, we'll need a lot more bold voices in our country in this space, right? So, but before we get into, which is also the topic for our episode, Black Women in the Workplace, which then also is the name of your organization, right? But before we get into that, who is Busisiwe Hlatshwayo? Can you let us in into your personal space in terms of who are you?
Okay. So my name is Busisiwe Hlatshwayo. I'm a Black Women Leadership Coach and founder of Black Women in the Workplace. And Black Women in the Workplace is a company that is aimed at helping Black women position themselves for leadership positions, navigate race and gender bias in the workplace, and be effective leaders in the workplace. I am originally from Pretoria, so I was raised in Mamelodi. And, you know, some people ask why, you know, what, how did you get to this place? Why did you start this organization? And I think that my life history, you know, as Steve Jobs says, you connect the dots from looking back.
Yes.
And when I look at my life history, I realize how my life was driving me towards this destiny.
Yes.
You know? I do not have any class advantage. I was you know, born in poverty, like many black young women.
Yeah.
You know, struggling. And I think if I go back and think of where this started, I was in the Adventist Church, mm-hmm. which I'm very grateful for, because I think I got a lot of training in terms of leadership, in terms of public speaking. Mm-hmm. You know, we used to have committees, and you'd have committees with, you know, professors mm-hmm. and professionals, CEOs in organization, mm-hmm. and you might be the leader leading meetings, reporting, you know, coming mm-hmm. up with strategies for the year. So mm-hmm. that really built my leadership.
Yeah.
And I think it was at the church when I started thinking about women issues.
Yes.
I think the church is a great place, but sometimes you do find some level of misogyny against women.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when people want to be popular, you know, they'll have these sermons against women. Why do you dress this way? You know,
Yes,
and
yes.
you feel like, but what is my place? Yes. Where is my place here? Yeah.
Mm.
And so when I started going into preaching and talking, because in the Adventist Church you have a chance to, you know, preach, to speak,
yes.
All of you, I yes. started really researching the role of women in the Bible.
Yes.
And where do they stand? And so I started yes. preaching around that area, around women.
Yes.
And kind of dispelling some of the myths uh-huh. around how women have been portrayed sometimes.
Yes.
In the way people preach,
uh-huh.
which is not necessarily how often the way the Bible defines them or with the way the stories are told.
Yes.
So I really wanted to find myself
yes.
in this place. So it started there. Mm-hmm. I've since deconstructed my religion and I've opened it up. So
yeah.
it's no longer so, my spirituality is no longer so organized religion. But that's where I started. And I really
yes.
want to honor the church for you know, for shaping me and uh-huh. for training me.
Yes.
And then it's also the women in my family. My mother was a very strong woman. She
yes.
had to be, you
yes.
know. She was an orphan at a very early age. I mean, we grew up in my great-grandfather's house.
Mm.
And fortunately, she worked, even though she worked very hard.
Mm.
I mean, she used to work. She used to take the train. I remember it was school holidays, so I went to work with her. And the train ride was 2.5 hours going and back.
Sure.
And she would work 1 week day shift, 1 week night shift. So if she's working night shift, she'd get home around 8.
Mm.
And at 2 p.m. she needs to go back. You know, so she worked very hard.
Mm.
And so it was a very tough period for her. And I think the family relied on her a lot.
Mm.
And I think for me, that was a first example
yeah.
of strength,
yes.
of pushing through, of leadership even,
uh-huh.
you know, from a family point of view.
Yes.
And then so I think my first brush with race, because
uh-huh.
I've already spoken about my brush with gender
yes.
within the black community,
yes.
because that doesn't come up, race doesn't come up a lot, but
yes.
gender came up, race came up when I went to the University of Pretoria to
yes.
study there. And I won't say that I had an experience of racism.
Yeah.
But the culture was so different. The
yes.
culture is very African. You know, thanks y'all and all of those things.
Yes.
So you're just coming in, and I had always been in the black community all my life, primary school, high school.
Yes.
I was affirmed for my intelligence. You know, I was at home. I was known. I'm the smart one.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
I'm Mrs. Number One. You know, this was the time of number one, number two, number one.
Yes.
And then I get to this place and all of a sudden I'm invisible.
Uh-huh.
I feel inferior.
Uh-huh.
I'm struggling in university. All of a sudden, I'm not the smart one.
Yes.
You know, I'm failing and failing really badly, you know? And I think for a long time, I carried a lot of shame because of that. But now I realize that the education that we got did not prepare us for that type of, you know, I mean, we study from different places, from different schools, which have different investment, and then we all meet in university.
Yes.
You know,
mm-hmm.
with different levels of preparation.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
And also when I read the book by Michelle Obama, where mm-hmm. she talks about, you know, her experience at Princeton.
Mm.
And she talks about how she saw the black students sitting together. And even though you don't see it as a race thing, but you find that you need each other. You know, you go to each other to find that home, that a place where I'm seen.
More of a safe space.
More of a place where you can be you, yourself, and really find yourself in this place. Because we are now in this class, and I think at that time we probably were 20% of the class as black students. I mean, I'm not that old. It was 2001? So, okay, maybe the younger ones would say you're old. But yeah. But 2001, so we're about like 20% of the class. It was already English. We had an English and Afrikaans class. I had now that they only have English. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
But, so you're 20% of the class, you're sitting together in the front there, and you know, you see white students just enjoying themselves, talking back to the lecturers, back and forth, and you are just bewildered. The examples, the level, the complexity of the language just passes over you. Mm. It was the weirdest feeling.
Mm.
And a friend of mine, a fellow student, Don Bata, she's now, I think, a CFO at IEC.
Mm.
She started in us in a group. So we meet every Wednesday. We used to call it Power Wednesday, where we turn on the lights. We just met every Wednesday. We met, I think the other member was Vincent Mutola. He's now the chairperson of SAICA and the CFO at UCT.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd meet there and other friends of ours, and we'd meet there and we'd just encourage one another.
Uh-huh.
And we'd just encourage one another, encourage one another. Mm. But I had, because of my background, I struggled.
Yeah.
And I couldn't finish the CA route. And that was a lot of shame. I had a lot of shame around that. And now when I go back, I realize that, I was ill-prepared. I did not have enough resources. And these are the realities of coming from a history of oppression that did not allow a lot of people to have access, to class, to money, to funds, to take care of themselves.
Uh-huh.
So that kind of shaped my thinking around race. And then when I finished my degree, so I didn't do my honors. When I finished my degree, I worked for one of the big four companies. I started with I started working for an entrepreneur, and then the next year I got articles with the idea that if I pass, I can continue. But it didn't work out. But when I was there as well, I am struggling in this place. I'm just struggling.
More like the struggle continues.
God. I don't have a car. So article clerks and nothing and peanuts. But the idea is that if you have a car, then you can claim kilos and then at least...
Yeah.
You know, help yourself out. And at that time, there were no allowance for taxis. So if you're a taxi person, you're on your own. Because there's no process of claiming.
Yes.
So the client will be in the Bundu somewhere. You must take two taxis, heels, you know? It was just... it was just when we laugh. And this is the face of the impact of racism, you know, on oppression, on the real lives of people, you know? So I really struggled there. I also disappeared them. And then until I decided, okay, this is not going to work. From where I come from, earning this little and not moving forward, this is just not going to work.
Yeah.
I need to look for a job.
Yeah.
And so I started reading around. I used to only... I think one of the things that also helped me is that I loved reading.
Yeah.
So I was never... active, you know. I was never good at activities. I was never a sports person.
Yes.
I was not very good, you know. Kind, you're not very good, you know.
So thing, your go-to place then,
my
books.
Thing was books. I was just high, because you know was in our families, a girl can't be sitting around not doing anything.
Yeah.
So I would hide. There was a space behind the bed. I would just hide there and read, and that was my pastime. And my sister was 4 years older than me. So that's where I would get the books. I would read her books.
Yeah.
And before I learned English, I would just read the theirs, because that was the only word I could read until I could learn to read.
Uh-huh.
So I really loved reading. Where was I going with this? But so I had the curiosity of what is happening.
Yeah.
And then when I got really deep into church, the only reading I would read would be religious books. And then I met this girl. I think we were talking about interviews. She's like, no, don't just read church books. Read personal development books. You know?
Yes.
And I'm so glad that she did. She said that, because then I started reading. And then as I'm reading, I learned that there is a way that you show up at work. You know, you don't just come in. It's not school where you study and work hard. There's just a way that you show up. And I don't remember the book, but I read it, and there was one chapter that said double your income in 3 months.
Yeah.
And I read the chapter, and in 3 months I had gotten a job that has double the income.
Okay. Yeah.
It's like, okay, it works. But in any case, it was, I mean, I was moving from article, so everything was going to be double. Anything I'm going to get there was going to be double. But anyway, but it taught me principles of how do you show up in a way that you're seen. And when I got that job, within a year, they approached me for a promotion. And, you know, this... And every 3 years, I would get promoted just from implementing those strategies.
Yeah.
But then I started asking myself, oh, what happened? I think I worked for a white company, a very predominantly white company.
Yes.
And I found that there were challenges there. And that made me... to try to understand what were the issues.
Yeah.
I had always wanted to start my own company.
Yeah.
So I thought it was going to be a leadership and a motivation company, which is one of the lessons that you learn when you get into entrepreneurship. That the difference between entrepreneurship and a job is that it's not about how well you work. You know, in a job, you can be a specialist.
Uh-huh.
And then there's a receptionist, there's the admin person, there's an IT person, there's all of that.
Yeah.
But when you get to a company, it doesn't work that way. You are everything. Mm-hmm. And the biggest skill that you need to learn is marketing.
Yep.
So I took my pension and hired officers, got my coaching qualification. I think when I started my company in 2015, it was Launchpad.
Yeah.
And I fell on my face, like royally. Yeah, like really failed.
So let me just hang on, you know, because this is like really now starting to get interesting, right? But before you actually then started your company, you know, so what were, you know, some of the major challenges, you know, that you faced in the workplace, right? You know, at the time that actually then pushed you to actually say, look, let me take the step
a leap of faith, because it sounds like it's a leap of faith type of a situation, but you'll tell us more about it. But, you know, what were some of your experiences?
Thank you for the question. Actually reminding me of what happened just before I resigned. So I've always wanted to, you know, to be a coach, and there's always that seed of I want to be an entrepreneur, but it was going to happen later because I did not have any financial backing, and I was also a young mother. I had had my child, my son, the love of my life. I shouldn't say that, he's going to have his own life, but my son at 15. So I was already a mother when I started working. So so I had to always think about him when I think of any...
That's another story that you'll come back to, right?
Yeah, okay. We can come back to.
All right, so...
He's 27 now, can you imagine?
Oh my God. I'm tempted to that, how old are you? Okay, maybe we'll do that, man.
You 15, can do 27. That,
okay, yes.
So it was always, I had to think about that. And also, I didn't come from a financially well-off family.
Yes.
So any decision I had to make, I had to think about that. So it was going to happen, but at some point in the future, you know. And then I got a promotion and moved to Cape Town. Oh my God,
then the fun begins.
OMG. They showed me flames. I saw flames. That's when I learned that the word noted in an email means, it doesn't mean noted. It means something else. It means whatever. You know?
Can
it
you
doesn't
tell us,
always mean
can,
that. But
can you
yeah.
tell us more about that?
I will tell you. So I got in there. I was a risk manager. Had gotten into this office. And Cape Town, obviously, is not a predominantly black place.
Yeah.
It might be black colored, like Indian, and then white, you know? So this office was doing very well. It was well known that it's doing very well. I come from a risk management perspective.
Yes.
So we are going to identify risks, you know, tell the company how we're going to mitigate them.
Yes.
We're going to report them.
Yes.
I report to head office.
Uh-huh.
I don't report here.
Mm-hmm.
And my level is a little bit higher than the other managers. Uh-huh. So for the supervisor and for the GM, I think.
Yeah.
So I get in there, go from Joburg. You know, work hard, come up, meet with people, write the risk down, go and report to them. And I don't know what is happening up there based on the reports. This is also, you know, branch is doing well. All of a sudden, there are things, you know?
Mm.
So apparently there was a meeting. So there was a lady there who was originally from Joburg.
Okay.
So we became very close.
Okay.
So apparently there was a meeting where they said, oh, okay, she's here to sabotage us. Anyway, anything is a risk. A chair is a risk. When you sit in a chair, it's a risk. You can fall, you know? And so we are going to freeze her out of meetings. Mm. And when she sends an email, just sends noted. Just say noted. Just say noted. I was frozen out, unable to do my job. And I think I was not ready for that. I fell apart.
Yeah.
Resigned, ran away. Just like, whoa.
What is this? Yeah.
Yeah, I think I always say it was around Madonsela, Patricia, what's her name? Madonsela, Pumzila Madonsela.
Uh-huh.
Is it Pumzila?
No, Tuli.
Tuli Madonsela.
Yes. Yeah.
It was around Tuli Madonsela. Like, I pulled the Tuli Madonsela and I saw flames.
Yeah.
But now going back, when I start researching these issues, I see.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. My ignorance of the dynamics of coming into leadership, into power space, of seeing the impact of anything that I do and how it, what what happens to it. So and that is part of the work that I do with Black women in the workplace. So what I found is that and how I got to start the company is that when we've left now,
yeah,
we started a company, All Things Women. Yeah, I fell and then started again. And then we went to meet the Commission for Employment Equity, the head.
Yeah.
And so she kind of, you know, took us through the report.
Yes.
And then she also raised it that she's seeing that Black women are not going through. Black, especially Black African women,
yes,
are not, the representation is not changing.
They
are, the representation, especially in top leadership, it's not happening. And one of the insights that we're finding was that the issue was the delay. First, there are two issues, there are two places where they get stuck. The issues where the delay first, in terms of the first first ascent into leadership, so, so that first promotion, they call it the broken rung, so that first promotion is difficult to get into, so they get delayed, they get to that very late, and then if once they get there, they're stuck at middle management. Pushing through to senior leadership is hard. Top leadership, you know, they're a myth, you know, they're like an, but unicorn, they're unicorns. And so that took me down a rabbit hole of trying to understand, but what are the issues? And as I go down the rabbit hole, I find myself.
So what was your aha moment in that rabbit hole?
There's so many.
Yeah.
I think one of the questions that I have, I had a couple of questions. One question was, what is wrong with Black people? What's wrong with us? Why are we struggling everywhere, in every country that we're in, where the marginalized? What is wrong with us?
Yes.
You know, are we really maybe not as intelligent, you know?
Yeah.
And then I started going into history, and then you realize, that, especially in South Africa, we don't learn history. You know, we just learn Jan van der Beek came, at that time anyway. Jan van der Beek came, 1961. And also you learn when you go into decolonization, Pan-African reading, that history comes from a perspective of the one who wrote it.
Yes.
And then when you go down and understand the impact of colonization and the impact of racism on our past and our ability to get ahead, then you start understanding. But what I learned, thank you so much. But what I learned was now the intersectionality, the issue of the intersectionality. So what happens with, what happened with transformation is that the decision to transform, obviously the default is the default leader. And because, you know, the people who started companies, the people were in power because of colonization and apartheid were white and male. So the default is white and male. And then everybody else is marginalized. So what, because the default is white and male, and when they say now it's time for transformation, we really need to redress this. What happens is that the measures to transform look at Black people as a group, and then it looks at women as a group. But you find that when we talk issues around Black people, we end up talking issues around that impact Black men. Mostly because they're the leaders, they're the most outspoken. And when we go into women's issues, we talk about issues. Obviously, if we are all a group, we are going to talk about issues that impact all of us as women. And the issues that are going to be at the forefront are going to be issues that impact white women. So the issues that impact other races end up not showing up. And I saw this, one of the texts that I was reading that really articulated this was McKinsey, the McKinsey Institute creates a few texts, please. So the McKinsey Institute does a Women in the Workplace report every year. And in 2020, they did a State of Black Women in the Workplace report.
Yeah.
And in that report, they articulated the issues around the intersectionality of the Black woman's experience.
Mm.
So for an example, Black women, Black women would face the same things that Black men face and the same things that women or women face. But the impact of their race creates a different experience, additional experiences. For an example, there's no other race that is called angry, the angry Black woman stereotype, you know, the strong Black woman stereotype. The mammy archetype, the mammy stereotype is that we, you know, the ever devoted domestic worker who loves, you know, working hard and doesn't want, they just love working and they're part of the family. And so even when we get to the workplace.
Oh, you know what, Musi? Honestly, you are triggering so many thoughts. You are honestly triggering so many thoughts because, you know, it's such a triggering trope, yeah, you know, this strong Black woman, you know. So I'm just thinking that. You know, looking at, I know that we're talking in the context of African Black women, yeah, right? Yeah. But then, you know, I think you did mention that I think you mentioned the Minister of Employment Equity, you had a discussion with her a few years back when you started your organization. So looking at our constitution, yeah, because, you know, I also don't want us to maybe present sort of, yes, we talk about our experiences, yes, because these are real experiences, right? Yeah. But then how do we get the Black women brand out of the victim mentality?
Yes.
You know, so how do we get there? Because, you know, also just looking back at some of the episodes that I recorded, there was an episode that I had with a lady called Nom Tandazo. You know, where she mentioned that, you know, so much time has passed. Yes, we've had all of these painful experiences and how we experienced either university or school and coming in and whatnot. And then through time, then you get into certain spaces because of our upbringing. Sometimes it becomes difficult for us to actually realize that where we are today, we actually have the privilege and actually maybe the power to position and to present ourselves as victors versus victims, you know. So then in the context, so coming back then in the context, a more directed question, you know, in this picture that I've just painted, you know, so how does our constitution, so someone who's listening to this, right, and say, okay, here's Musi, here's a story, some of the struggles, background, you know, and all of this, how does then our constitution define Black women, you know?
Thank you.
And then what does this do in relation to other women that are not defined as Black?
Yes.
So we'll come back to that to talk about that.
Yes.
But then given the context of the work that you do and your experiences, can we then just unpack that in that context?
Yes. Yes, thank you for leading me to that question. So when you look at the employment equity stats, so I spoke to the chairperson of the organization, so not the minister. So when you look at the employment equity stats, I think they stopped in 2023, in 2022, but up until 2021, they would break down the stats into white men, Indian men, Black Indian, Black colored, Black African, men, and then white women, Black Indian women, Black African, Black colored women, Black African women, and what it showed was that white men are 5% of the country.
Yeah.
And at some point they were about 60-70% of the top leadership.
Yeah.
But now they're about 50%. So we are getting some traction.
Yeah.
In terms of diversity in leadership.
Yeah.
But you find that Black African men are about 44% of the country, of those stats, and they're about 10% of top leaders.
Yeah.
And then Black women are about 37-38% there. and they make up about 6-7%, mm-hmm. and the stats are over 3 years, mm-hmm. so they show you the trajectory throughout the years, and it's always 0.6 change, 0.6%, 0.5% change. So the change is very slow.
Yeah.
In terms of representation, and yeah. then you look at white women.
Yeah.
White women, I think about 4% of the economically active EAP, population.
Yeah.
Because it's not population.
Yeah, it's EAP. Economic,
yes,
yeah.
It's EAP. So they're about 4%, and they are about 13% of the top leaders.
Mm.
So what we learn from that is that transformation is advantaging very much mm-hmm. the white women's representation, and that makes sense
mm-hmm.
because when you understand the different biases, conscious biases that happen in the workplace, there's this bias that is called affinity bias,
mm-hmm.
and it says that so for people to get ahead, they need mentorship, they need sponsorship, they need mm-hmm. someone to advocate for them to get further,
uh-huh.
and because it's very easy to relate to people we've known
uh-huh.
who remind us of who we are.
Mm-hmm.
If people who are in leadership are white men at that uh-huh. time, the people who are closest
mm-hmm.
are white women.
Mm-hmm.
So that's just affinity, besides even thinking about racism and sexism.
Mm-hmm.
So you find that in terms of their representation, the measures towards employment equity are helping accelerated their representation very highly, very fast.
Mm-hmm.
So they are 4% of the country, 3.9,
mm-hmm.
and about 13% at that time. I think it was mm-hmm. 2021.
Mm.
And then you look at the Indian population. I think they were like 1%, if I'm not sure,
mm-hmm.
but a very low percentage,
mm-hmm.
and also highly represented.
Yeah.
And then the next is the black coloreds.
Yeah.
And obviously, and men are always more represented than women.
Women. Yeah.
So now, when you start unpacking the reasons for that, one is that there was a hierarchy in this country of non-whites, and that impacted on the investment in terms of education, for example, in terms of the places they got to live. We know
mm-hmm.
so the hierarchy was Indian, coloreds, and black people, and even the investment in terms of education, in terms of the places they stayed, whites the best, and then Indians a little bit better, coloreds a little bit better, and then you know, the rest. So that is reflected there. So
yeah.
That's why it is very important. That's why it is important that we do not just say women.
Yeah.
And also that's why it is important that we do not just say black women
mm-hmm.
or the term that is used in the US, women of color.
Yeah.
If we are going to be fully represented in those spaces,
uh-huh.
we have to pull all of us, all uh-huh. of our different experiences, because
yes.
when we don't,
uh-huh.
it is reflected in the statistics
yes.
that those peoples whose experiences are not highlighted
yeah.
remain behind.
Yeah.
And it's the same issue in the US. When I talk about that report,
uh-huh.
there is a quote there that says, women's white women's experiences are worse than men's experiences in the workplace.
Mm-hmm.
The women's of color
mm-hmm.
are even worse than white women, and the black woman's experience is the worst of them all. And another quote that drives my work is a quote from, so there was there's this group in the U.S. called the Combahee River Collection.
Mm-hmm.
And it was black women who sat and said, you know, we are in these movements of emancipation, of struggle.
Mm-hmm.
We sit with men
mm-hmm.
and we work with them. But when we raise our issues, they say, "Ah, wait."
Mm.
You know, it doesn't matter. And also, there is some oppression towards us as
yeah.
they are women.
Mm.
And when we're sitting in women's issues as well, when we raise our issues, it's weight.
Yeah.
So we sat down and said there are issues that impact us because of the intersectionality, and in some ways they call it the overlapping experience of not just being a woman and not just being black, but the intersectionality of that experience. And it's fascinating that a few days ago, I've been wanting to read Dr. Judy Dlamini's book, Equal But Different. And in the first chapter, she really goes into those issues that one of the things that are an issue is that blackness came with class issues as well.
Yeah.
You know? And class issues then is also about what access do you have? What is your... Also, well, even though she didn't talk about those things, but things like, you know, what is your accent? And how does that impact you? You know? Where do you come from? When I read the book, I'm realizing that a lot of people who did well... A lot of black women who did well when transformation was happening. Black women who either studied overseas, you know, who either came from better class privilege, studied overseas or studied in the other countries because their parents could, you know, maybe was raised in exile or just had some sort of privilege between children of teachers.
Yeah.
But, and which does not... Which does not exclude them from the challenges that they face. Because Dr. Judy Lemon talks about it, that, gosh, she got into the workplace and faced racism for the really up in her face, you know? So when we do not go down deep into the underlying issues of everybody's experience, people get lost in the process. And what is happening is that black African women get lost in the process because it's such a triggering issue.
Yes.
And often our anger is policed, you know. But I want to it's policed so when we start speaking up, we align ourselves to the trope of the angry black woman. so you can't even raise these issues. But I really want to speak to the victim. And yes. I want to... So all of these issues that I was speaking about really external issues.
Yes.
So it's the external issues that you face because you're the unconscious bias that you face because you're a black woman.
Yeah.
And then the unconscious bias that we all face as women.
Yeah.
For an example, I spoke about the affinity bias.
Uh-huh.
One of the other biases is competency bias.
Uh-huh.
So this idea that a leader is a man, and if you're a woman, you're not a good leader. So you have to prove, you know, to double the work for half, you know.
Yes.
So you have to prove yourself that you can do the work. You know, they always talk about how women only apply for posts when they're 100%, then men apply for posts when they're 60%. And it's because women are not doing... No, we know that our CV is going to be looked differently from the CV of a man.
Yeah.
You know, because the assumption, the unconscious bias is that men can lead and women can't. So that's the competency bias. And
that is so true, because I think I'm actually internalizing what you're saying, because at some point in my career, in my journey, I used to be called an iron lady. But anyway.
Yeah. Yes. And when you talk, that's also another bias. So women are expected to be likable at work because of societal conditioning that, you know, we are the sweet, the nurturing gender.
Yeah.
But when you're liked, you're not respected.
Yep.
And then when you iron, you're hated.
Exactly.
And yes, sometimes it's better to be respected rather than liked. But if there's a position, there's promotion, and there's two of you, and you're not liked, who's going to get it? If there's support for your ideas and all of that, and you need advocacy, if you're not liked, how is that going to help you? So we're always walking that tightrope between likability and respectability.
Yeah.
You know? And then the other issues, you know, the motherhood. You know, you're pregnant. Oh, you guys are pregnant. You're going to leave work for a year. You know, and many women find that when they come back, their jobs are gone. they're demoted, all of those things. And also, you know, asking for time because your child is sick and all of those things. So there's that impact. And then black women also, what we found is that even though there's a pay gap, what research shows that there's a pay gap between men and women, but it also differs between white women and women of, and women of color and black women. Black women are the farthest in terms of the pay gap. And you know, most you can say, but that's what he used to earn, all of those things. And this idea that, I mean, Oprah did a video about it that, you know, when she asked for more money, her boss was like, and why? So, but we're doing the same job. But why? You're a woman. What are you going to do?
And
he's got a family. Do you have a family? You know? And even though you won't get people saying that directly to you, but that happens where black women earn less. Then I spoke about the other biases. So that is an external issue. Mm-hmm. Those are the unconscious biases that you face.
Mm.
Coming back home, how we are raised... we are raised to prepare us for marriage, you know, prepare us for motherhood, prepare us to be good, respected. Most of the time, obviously, the black woman's experience is not monolithic. We come from different families. Other people come from very advanced professional families where, you know... gender equality.
So it's all relative in this context.
But generally we are prepared for marriage. We are told that we should be humble. And also there's a book called Corporate Tribalism that, you know, that unpacks, it's a US book, so that unpacks the white men, the white women, and then the other races. And they talk about, for an example, and because the workplace culture is very Western, it's very individualistic, it's very, you must advocate for yourself. If you want a promotion, you must, you know, you must advocate for yourself. If you're not paid well, you must come and advocate. You must, you know, you must come and ask to be mentored. You must, you know, come
like
and
put yourself and out there.
Put yourself out there. If it's a performance evaluation, speak for yourself. But most often we come from communities, you know, Stere talks about it. We come from cultures where you respect authority. Authority is further than you. You don't speak up against authority. You wait to be seen, you know. And they even use this statement that my manager is my scorecard. If you know, if I'm working hard, then my manager will see me and promote me. And if they don't, it's not in my cultural orientation that I go and advocate for myself. So there is that challenge where you're working in a culture that's very different from the culture that which you have been oriented. And especially for women, because we raise girls differently than we raise boys. You know, is it Professor Pumla Gola? Talks about the fact that the public arena is the arena of men, and then the private home is the arena of women. So you still have to overcome all of those, and no one tells you, no one prepares you. It's not taught at school. It's if you are the first professional in their family, you won't hear this until you get emails that says noted. You won't hear this.
And then in your mind, you're like, okay, noted. Okay, we're on the same page. We agree.
You know?
So I'm sorted. I'm fine.
You know?
It doesn't click that, it means something else.
You know? So how we are raised. And then the impact of poverty on your self-esteem, the level of education that I've just spoken about, also how, obviously, because the economic space is Western is white, how markers of whiteness are seen as competence. So when you roll, you know, when you come from these schools and you roll, and now you're from Venda, Shem, with your thick.
You're from KZN.
You're from KZN with your thick Zulu accent. with your broken English. You're very smart, but articulation, you never had an opportunity to refine your articulation.
Yes.
So those things, and then also the cultural idea that we should submit to men, we should be less than men. A man is a leader. A man is higher than you. So you find that you get to the workplace, you see a malume.
No, Busi, you are so engaging. My gosh, I don't even know. Like, how long have we been talking? It's like, how much time? You know? So, but I think let me just stop you because you're going to get into another space and I'm just going to lose my train of thought.
Before we stop, I want to talk to victimhood.
Yes.
Because this comes up a lot.
Yeah.
What my observation has seen that there are three stages that black women go through. So the first stage, or women go through.
Yeah.
The first stage is when you're oblivious to these challenges. You're just oblivious.
Uh-huh.
And I talked about how I had shame for so long because of my failures. This is when you're oblivious and you think, it's me.
Yeah.
I'm not good enough.
Yeah.
I'm not smart enough. You know, I didn't work hard enough. I didn't try enough. All of those things. This is where you internalize everything as I am not good enough, and that's when it impacts your mental health and you find people, you know, get onboarded for help because it's just I am failing in this thing that I wanted to do. And then the second stage is when you start to learn about these things. And then you go in. So the first one, I call it the unconscious victim. You're just a victim, but unconscious. You just internalize everything. The second stage is conscious victim. Now you learn about these things and you say, no, they're not going to tell me anything. No, it's because I'm black. Oh, it's because I'm black. It's because of... You go into full-on victim anger. No agency mode. I'm just a victim. It's the system. There's, you know, they're out to get me. They're out to get me and all of that. And I feel when you're in that, so when you're in the first phase, really educate yourself. When you're in the second phase, really educate yourself and get support. But in your second phase, it's really a time to heal.
Uh-huh.
You need to work on your healing
And forgiveness.
Really, and forgiveness and understanding your agency.
Yeah.
And then the third stage is when you realize, okay, the system is the system, is how it is, and sometimes people are not against you. They just have
it's how it is.
It's how it is. And also there's a game in the workplace and no one teaches you. So if you don't understand power and how power is navigated, you're going to have a challenge. So then you start educating yourself to see, okay, how did Maya bring in my orientation not prepare me? How do I empower myself? How do I understand this space of power and navigate it consciously? How do I create that? How do you now?
And why do I always hit these roadblocks?
Yeah.
You know, what causes that? So I think you are absolutely, absolutely right, Busisiwe, because then when you then get to really get into the healing and the forgiveness, not just forgiving other people, because sometimes the victim mentality is like, okay, you know what, these people did this to me, right?
Yes.
But then you start to think about, how do I also forgive myself for what was my contribution? What could I have done differently? You know, so how could I have showed up differently had I known better, right? You know, so I think then that's the I think that's a sweet spot, if I can call it that,
because
then once you get over that, and then you get into your full self.
Yeah,
I think hence we have you today, right? Because I think if you are not in your full self, you cannot, one, confidently, and two, with conviction, talk about these things without evoking negative emotions, but then also bleeding on people that didn't hurt you, but use your experiences to actually share them with the world in terms of, you know, how you show up, which is then the space that you are in, which will you know, lead me to, because then I'm going to ask you a follow-up question. Yeah, you started your organization in May 2015, and now we're in 2024. So I'm sure, obviously, there's a whole journey and stories, but then you interact then with other women, right, in your coaching space, and you talk to a lot of probably young professionals. And so can you just paint that picture for us? Because I think we've been talking about your experiences and what you've seen and some of the concepts and some of the real experiences. So what are you then hearing?
Okay.
You know, just the people that are either your clients, being in 2024, I think now it's like 30 years of our democracy, you know, and why do we, 30 years later, you know, we still talk about these things because it's a real issue. So what are you seeing in your space from all of the women from different walks of life and different experiences? What are you hearing and seeing?
So 2015 was when I started my company, which was general, and I really niched into Black women in 2018. And also failing, going back to work. You know, failing, going back to work. And one of the, and just, okay, let me just leave this and answer this one, this question. But, so what I'm finding with the Black women that I meet is that when I, you know, I post a lot, and when I post, and when I meet with these women, they're like, I don't know. How do you know? How do you know that is what I'm going through? One of the biggest things is what I spoke about, that because we don't have a history and experience of if we're the first in the family, so no one prepared you on you know, of, on how do you navigate the workplace. You're told work hard and study hard, get the education, and when we get stuck, it's get another qualification. Get stuck, another qualification. So because I always say that if you only have a nail, as the saying goes, if you only have a nail, every problem, when you only have a hammer, every problem becomes a nail. So we have, what we've been given, our heritage is education and hard work. You know, so I find that these women say, I've worked hard and I've been promoted, but I feel stuck. I feel like I don't know what I need to know to move from here. And because there's this book that says what got you here will not take you there, that at a certain level, and I think it starts from just in middle management level, that work, hard work is not going to take you there, that your qualifications are not going to take you there, that you're going to start needing networks, that you're going to start needing a strong personal brand, you know, that you're going to start be talking solution to company problems. So the biggest thing that I'm seeing is that stuckness, and then also toxic workplaces, very painful experiences of toxic workplaces. In 2020 in the US, they were talking about the US is our, the US experience is very parallel to our experience as South Africans. I don't think as other African countries, because I think because they got some of their independence earlier, they didn't go through the apartheid, even though they went through colonization. But I think our experience is very keenly aligned to US women. And one of the things that happened in 2020 is that there was a lot of women leaving the workplace and saying, I can't do this. It's too much.
It's too painful.
It's too painful. It impacts my mental health too much. I'm just going to try and start my own business. And I'm seeing that a lot here, even in South Africa. A lot of also the women that are coming to me are saying, let's work on an exit strategy, you know? And then there are those who are still ambitious. And when they talk to me, they say, yo, I thought I just needed to work. My work should speak for myself. But now you've given me, you've awakened me to what else I need to do, because these things are not taught anywhere. But also we need to speak about what companies need to do. It can't be that we ask the very people who are marginalized to be the change.
Yes.
Companies need to do their part.
So just give us maybe two or three tips. What can companies do then in this space?
I think first of all, companies is the tone at the top. They have to really adopt, understand, and communicate that diversity, equity, inclusion, and belonging is what they want to do. It's a heart issue. You have to really buy in to the importance of this concept and not, not lip service. One. Secondly, you get an example of a lot of, and once you've done that, then it becomes part. Ursula Burns, who was the first black woman CEO of Xerox, talks about how in Xerox they would have each executive would be champions for different identities. So there'll be a champion for black women, there'll be a champion for women, there'll be a champion. And I really believe that if it's part of the scorecard and it's part of what you're paid for, then it becomes it scratches
gets weight. Real.
That's real. That's one. Two, education.
Yeah.
It's fascinating. You know, when I get into this and I read about it a lot and becomes what I know, but when I teach people, they're like, oh my goodness, I didn't know.
Mm.
I didn't know that. I was at Toastmasters yesterday and the men, they were like, wow, I never knew women, women go through this that I work with. I always say, work harder, you're coming. You know? And I never understood the real
challenge. Sometimes it's such a, it feels like an insult, right? You it's know, like, how much harder can it work?
So education. And then you have to embed that in the culture.
Yeah.
There needs to be, monitoring of, are we implementing the values? So microaggressions, how do we manage them, all of those things. And then the last thing is policies and procedures. Blind interviews, blind CVs, and then the last thing is advocacy. The people who have power, who are in power, are men.
Yeah.
And they are the ones who can create a change.
Yeah.
We can sit here and kill ourselves, but it's men who can advocate for us, who can be allies for us, who can say this is not fair, who can say let's look at how much she's paid. It's men. It's men who can mentor us. It's men who can advocate for us. So if they're not part of the conversation and they don't take it up as serious. And also, what they do at home.
Yeah.
Because one of the biggest issues, the impact on advancement of women is the burden at home.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. No, thank you for breaking it down so beautifully. I'm not even sure how we're doing for time. I feel like we can just talk, sit here. And how long have we gone for? It's like an hour? Yes, okay. So we just hit the hour mark. But I just have to ask this question, I really have to. You are so engaging. Thank you so much for coming through and just sharing really your experiences. Because I think you just really know how to when I listen to you, some of your videos on social media, even on LinkedIn, and I'm like, so such a rich woman, honestly, and they're just the type of people really that follow you. And the next episode that I will record here, I won't reveal the guest, but the name of the episode is called Leading Boldly into the Future. And then you're just one of those women that actually really represent this title for me, but then I think you've dealt with that, what can companies do and whatnot, but what can women themselves do, like women, specifically black African women, in the context of the pull head down syndrome? Because there's also that issue, we're dealing with, is that how can we show up better for ourselves and to support each other as sisters?
I think I'm going to start it from the other side, the expectation on black women who don't have power as well. First of all, you find that this black woman worked so hard to get to the top. And even there, she doesn't really hold full power. She's still fighting.
Yes.
You know, because power is a contested space.
Yeah.
You know, she's still being marginalized, still being questioned and all of that. So she's still struggling with that. And Puti Mahanyele talks about it, that she, when she got to the US and then she found that in this company that she was working for, and then she found that there's this black woman who was a leader.
Yeah.
And she went to her and said, yeah, can you mentor me? And this woman was like, I'm sure they'll take care of you, you know? Mm. And then she realized that she put that burden on her. Also, you know, also created that thing of, you are there and you must take care of everybody.
Mm.
So we need to also appreciate that they might be burnt out and they might be fighting real battles.
That they don't talk
that
about.
That they just do not have the strength to hold one person. And then secondly, what I've found is that when I talk to women, because I run also women in leadership programs with mixed women, what I've found is that a lot of women, more than the ones that I said are being pulled down, a lot of them say, the person who took care of me is a woman. The person who was my bestest boss is a woman.
Yeah.
So as much as we talk about it, it's not as prevalent. I think we don't talk enough about positive experiences of women assisting each other, women taking care of each other and helping each other out. So that's secondly.
Yeah.
And thirdly, yes, there is a pull me down, because there's also this thing of, if you're doing well as a woman, as a black woman, you are treated as a unicorn. You know, you're the first black woman to do this. Oh my goodness, you're the model black
person.
It's
such a setup. Hey, this
it's
first black woman thing.
Yeah, it is.
You
a
know,
setup.
Honestly, yes.
And can we just annihilate that? The fact that you're the first black woman doesn't mean you're the smartest or the greatest. It just means that you were smart and great at the right time, where things were open so that you can be able to get in. There were many who were smarter than you before you. It's just that the opportunities were not open to other women. So no, you are not the most amazing unicorn of blackness. No. So let's finish that. So this idea of I'm so enjoying the accolade, I can't have another person taking the spotlight. That is also an issue. Mm. And two, as also someone said in this book, they were saying that we're fighting for a space in the bottom. You know, so there's only this much space in this part, and only one of us can have it. So we are fighting against that. And then the last one is generational.
Yeah.
So women who came before us, who fought, who had to be men, and then they see you're wearing pink here, you coming late because you're taking your child to crash. Like, you're not taking this seriously. I worked so hard to get here, and you are just, you know? So there is also that thing of the generational differences that feels like I've worked so hard and you are not taking it seriously.
Yes.
So those are the issues, but yeah.
Yeah. Busi, thank you very much. Thank you. Before this turns into a 2-hour episode instead of a 1 hour. But thank you so much for your richness. So thank you so much just for being bold, for being you, and for just being open to just really talk about the real issues, you know. Because I think, you know, when I like your space, because, you know, you say things as they are, things that people think about, but they're either scared to say them. Or they don't know really, you know, how to share some of their experiences because people are afraid of being judged, you know, and I think a lot of it also comes with shame. So I think thank you for being a gift, right? Yeah. Because, you know, I can't imagine that life was easy. You did mention earlier that you had a child at 15. Maybe we should need to do about another episode around teenage pregnancy and what that means.
Yes, and really want to talk about.
And what that means in the context.
The child support grant, really. Yes. I hate the negativity around it. Seriously.
So actually, I'll call you back for that episode at some time later in the year.
Talk about that.
But, you know, thank you so much.
Yeah.
You know, thank you. We need more and more of you. And I think we really need to support each other, you know, and I'm just so proud of, you know, the network, you know, the community rather, that you have been able to build around yourself, because we know just leaving the safety net of corporate and starting your own business, it's like you go into this black hole, you don't know. And some of the things, they shock you, like, oh my goodness, because you can go in there so ambitious and you think you've got like this idea figured out, and then the minute you start doing this thing, there are like 100 other people doing the same thing that you know. But then the beauty of that, you know, so you know, I recently signed this partnership with Franklin Covey South Africa, and the more I engage in their content and I read about their content and whatnot, is that, you know, we might, you know, a person must actually make a commitment to create as platforms or situations or where there's mutual benefit. You know, so it must be a conscious effort that you make, that, you know, how can I engage in such a way that I create win-win situations for myself and others, rather than competing, because that's another thing that we don't talk about enough, right? That we see Busisiwe doing something, and then instead of going to Busisiwe and finding out, you know, what her experience is, what has she learned, how do we then elevate her? No, you want to look at Busisiwe and then go and compete, and you know, which then fits the purpose. But thank you so much.
Thank
you know,
you so
I can
much.
Go on and on and on, but let me stop. You know,
can I just say as well? Can I just say, I do it afraid. You know, it's a courageous thing.
Yes.
I do it afraid, and also it's easier now that I'm on my own. But there was a time when I was scared, and I'm not going to get any work because I speak about these issues. But they compelled me. You know, the passion compelled me. So I do it afraid, and I think that women should not feel bad when they're afraid to say these things. It's okay. It's a jungle out there. It's tough. So I do it afraid.
Yes.
Yeah, and let not be a confusion that I'm just this hero. It's sometimes scary, but I have to do it. Somebody has to do it.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for coming in. Thank you for tuning in. We have just really listened to a very engaging episode with Busisiwe Hlatshwayo, the founder of an organization called Black Women in the Workplace. Thank you for unpacking it so beautifully. We love you. We appreciate you. And this is the end.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.